letter to distribute to members and make a part of the record today. Any questions, Mr. Marcus? I assume the amendments to which you refer, I don't know that they've been previously identified, are those which consist of approximately 8 pages and are captioned proposed amendments to SB 566?
That's correct. There's no date or source on them. I just saw them for the first time less than 15, 20 minutes ago here.
Anything else from Mr. Marcus?
Chair.
Representative Hanlon.
Mr. Marcus, what amendments would you propose to make this livable?
Okay. To make it livable, the amendments I would propose are, first of all, to require the clerk, let me just kick them off. One, in the case of clerk-issued writs, I would require the clerk to ascertain that the judgment exists, that it hasn't been satisfied, and at least as reflected by court records, the amount sought by the writ is appropriate. And by that I mean, if it's seeking costs, they must have been taxed. It can't be an amount for more than the records demonstrate there has been satisfaction. The problem with Oregon civil procedure and collection of judgments is that you can't always tell from the court. I understand the practical problem. You can't tell from the record how much has actually been paid on the judgment. The clerk may be in no position to tell, but I would make the clerk responsible for what is of record in the courthouse. Two, with respect to returning the money on time after the clerk sends the notices, I would require that the court shall issue, in order to show cause re-contempt, that it be returnable at the same time and place as the hearing on the claim of exemption if one has already been set, instead of a may. The third thing I would do is create a civil penalty of at least $200 with the possibility of punitive damages and attorney fees, and expressly provide that it's available for all abuses by the Act, that it cannot be reduced by set off against the existing civil judgment. To make the thing really work and attractive, I would have some provision to remove the incentive for using it so that any monies interfered with by an improper garnishment would be deducted from the legitimate amount left on the bill, on the judgment. Those are the provisions I'd like to see. If all of those were in there, I would have a hard time doing anything but coming up and saying, we can't complain about the bill, perhaps except in concept. But if those things were in there, I wouldn't be driving down here on an hour's notice to make impassioned pleas.
Thank you. Any further questions? Okay, if not, I assume, Mr. Marcus, you're available to work with those individuals who have an interest in this in order that some compromise might be effected.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's it for those who have signed up. Were there other individuals who wish to testify on this? We've got another one or two, I think, before Mr. Sherman. Go ahead, sir.
Mr. Chair, subcommittee, my name is Mark Comstock. I'm an attorney practicing in Salem here. I also am on the executive committee of the debtor-creditor section of the Oregon State Bar, and I appear before you on behalf of that entity today. In listening to the testimony that's gone on before, I thought I might add a couple of things that would answer a couple questions. With regard to the costs that are involved in the issuance of a writ of garnishment currently, it is $3 to the court, but additionally there is a service fee that is required currently. And it's either $12.50 or $9.50, depending on what the county in which the writ is to be served, what the population is. Now, that sum is added into each writ. So off the top, under the proposed bill, you would have a substantial savings to each of the debtors each time a writ is issued, if it is issued outside of the court system. if it is served by mail. I think the current cost of a certified mailing is $1.77. I didn't do the subtraction, but there's a substantial savings right there to each time a writ is issued. Something that Mr. Marcus didn't indicate in his testimony is currently we have a system in Oregon that is not serving anyone well. It's not serving the state's interest in their paper flow in the courts themselves. It's not serving the creditor's interest in being able to get process issued. I represent creditors, and in fact, I sat on the State Court Administrators Committee.
Excuse me, Ms. Comstock, probably I should address this to Mr. Linden. Who, or maybe there was someone from your section of the State Bar, but was there anyone from legal aid or folks who might tend to be identified as representing the interests of the debtors who participated, or do you recall?
There was, when a bill was produced, there was a gentleman that did either was associated with a legal aid office or was a debtor attorney. That was a major portion of his practice. I can't recall his name at the moment, but there was someone who did have significant input on the initial bill that was proposed.
Thank you.
From my own experience in various counties, sometimes it has taken as much as 5 weeks to get a writ of garnishment issued. That serves no one. And also in the debtor, the debtor is not served by simply is an expensive system right now.
There's a five-week delay in the court processing these?
That I have experienced that in the past. I can't say that is always how it works, but I have experienced that in my own practice.
Is there any statutory limit?
No.
What causes, if any, are offered to explain these delays?
Just the number of writs that are available and I suppose the number of people that are available to process the paper. That's the only thing I couldn't understand.
Okay.
Mr. Marcus also didn't point out that the debtors have had an opportunity to contest this judgment already. This is post-judgment collection. They've already had their day in court, if you will. Mr. Marcus also didn't indicate that in his proposed amendments requiring the clerk to verify that there is a judgment that does exist, that it is unsatisfied, and at least referring to the court records what the correct balance is. Well, the A and Grossed provision of the bill does have, I think it's still Section 19, and it has an abstract of the judgment, which in a shorthand fashion identifies the costs that were awarded, the attorney's fees that were awarded, the method of arriving at the interest calculations. That's something that is required to be filed with the judgment, and it is on file with the clerk's office. So it's fairly easy to identify that, and the clerk can do that at that point. If the numbers do not agree, then I would submit that under the proposed amendments, the clerk can decline to issue the writ. As to the return of the monies, I guess I have a little more optimistic view of what attorneys and what creditors will do. I find that if a court tells them to do that, they normally do return the money in a prompt fashion, and the contempt sanction that is in the bill and the proposed amendments that have been proposed today, or at least submitted today do carry a significant sanction for members of the bar and for creditors existing in the state of Oregon. As to the civil penalties and not being offset against any judgment, I submit that Mr. Marcus is looking for a method to cure all ills of an imperfect world. It'd be nice if judgments were self-executing also. It isn't how the system works right now. Additionally, with the civil penalties and the automatic issuance of an order to appear and show cause, I would submit that's a major change in the law, which would be almost to the effect of a strict liability provision. I have reviewed the proposed amendments that the State Court Administrator's Office has presented today, and I have no problem with them. The debtor-creditor section executive committee has not had an opportunity to review those. I received them a couple hours ago, or at least talked with Mr. Swank a couple hours ago. As to the engrossed version of the bill, the debtor-creditor section does support it. We had some initial opposition because the attorneys were required, or the private attorneys were required to hold funds in their trust account, in trust for the court. That has been taken out, and that was, my understanding, the PLF's problem with the bill. I talked with Mr. Les Rawls yesterday about the A and Gross version of the bill, and he did not have a problem with the A and Gross version of the bill. So I would submit the private bar doesn't have a problem with the A and Gross version, and I'd submit that the proposed amendments today are answering the legal aid concerns. I would urge that the committee recommend a due pass on the A and Gross version with today's amendments. Any questions, I'll be happy to respond if I can.
Okay, thanks, Mark. Any questions for Mr. Comstock? If not, thanks for your opportunity to appear today. Anyone else? Mr. Sherman?
Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Ken Sherman, Jr., office at 687 Court Street, represent the Oregon Bankers Association. To speak very briefly regarding our current status in this process, we have just in the last 24 hours received the A.N. Gross version of the bill. We've been through that fairly thoroughly and are now in the midst of conversations with Brad. We have a few, I think, minor concerns about some of the things in the A.N. Gross version of the bill. Without getting into detail, those concerns relate primarily to some of the instructions that are given to the parties on the writ of garnishment and in the law itself as to how to respond to a garnishment. I think those are primarily procedural things with a little bit more opportunity for discussion and work we can iron out, but at this point we still have those concerns. Now, in the A.N. Gross bill, there remains one major area of concern that we have that is more substantive, and that pertains to our concerns relative to the obligation that would be created by the bill for the bank, and that's my concern here, once it receives a garnishment, to respond first by sending in its certificate and then to hold the funds which are the subject of the garnishment for a period of 10 days before sending those funds on. Understand the concern about having the funds held so as to give an opportunity for the filing of a claim of exemption. Have no problem with that. Our problem is the procedural one that we foresee the banks having in trying to line things up so that you send the certificate on day one and then send the money with whatever changes may have occurred in the account and so forth on day 10. Today, the bank typically will respond to a garnishment in one step. They file or fill out the certificate, and they submit the certificate together with whatever is in the account, all in one step. And that allows us to be relatively error-free, and that's, frankly, a very large concern for us. We are very fearful that if we get into this role of stakeholder during this 10-day period, that there's going to be tremendous opportunity for mistakes and for oversights and for questions, legal questions, as to what happens during that 10-day period. And we would much prefer that if there needs to be a stakeholder, that that stakeholder be someone who is in the process, or the clerk of the court, or someone else. But we've got a real concern about that aspect of it, and Mr. Swank and I are now in the process of discussing that, and we're, I think, more than willing to discuss it with any other interested parties. But right now, that's our concern. As to these new amendments, I just received these 15 minutes ago. I haven't even had the opportunity to read them yet. Brad has explained a little bit of what's in them, and we just need to take the time to look at those, and we'll do so as quickly as possible.
Mr. Chairman, I have zero practice experience in this area, so help me out a little bit. Under current practice, when one of your clients, a bank, receives the writ, are you required, or as a matter of practice, what confirmation, or do you act upon the authority of the writ in itself to then respond and forward? I don't know procedurally how you freeze an account, or I'm not sure the problems you're describing, particularly in this 10-day period, if there were additional demands placed upon the account, what your responsibility would be during that period of time, or just in terms of accounting, what you have to do if you have to deal with that 10-day period. Can you maybe explain that a little bit further?
Mr. Chairman, I'll try. We have some of those same concerns, and as I said earlier, our general practice at the present time is that when the garnishment comes in, we make a decision, we examine the writ, we make a decision as to whether or not we have funds or other property of this debtor in our possession, and if we do, we immediately respond and send the money off to wherever it's supposed to go. And that's all done in one step. So you don't have to worry about, well, what about additional funds that come in after the fact and that sort of thing. Now, as a practical matter, and this is current law, the bank has a period of 5 days in which to respond to a garnishment, and so does any other garnishee. They have that 5-day period in which to respond. And frequently, a bank, particularly if they've got some question about the garnishment, for instance, if they're not quite sure of the some question about the debtor's identity or something like that, they may use that period to try and gain some additional information, either from the plaintiff or from the debtor, who is the bank's customer or some other source, and try and even encourage the parties to resolve their financial problem outside of the garnishment. Frequently, we will advise banks during that 5-day period where, for instance, you've got a garnishment of an IRA, and you probably are aware that you withdraw funds early from an IRA, you've got lots of problems in terms of taxes and penalties and so forth. We will frequently advise a bank in that situation to call their customer and say, look, we've got this thing. We're required to respond to it. Right now, we'll give you a day or two or 5 days to work this out. But during this time, get your financial problem with your creditor solved by some other means so we don't have to touch your IRA. So that's kind of a nutshell of the present practice. What I'm greatly concerned about is creating a mechanism where, and we've got institutions that handle hundreds of garnishments a month. We have banks that are large enough that they have whole departments that do nothing but handle garnishments. And the nightmare of trying to administer a system where you're holding funds for a period of time after you've submitted the certificate is what is our concern in this area.
Counsel?
Right, Mr. Sherman. What you're saying is that if in this 10-day period you were received a garnishment and were by mistake to give money to the debtor, I guess, the person who's being garnished, that you'd have potential liability there for misdirecting the funds.
If we gave the money that was garnished?
Right.
Yes, we would have potential liability. The law says that if we, in effect, ignore the garnishment, which is what we would be doing in that example, because whatever we have in our possession up to the amount needed to satisfy the debt for which the garnishment is issued is garnished and is subject to the garnishment the moment the garnishment comes in. So if we, in effect, ignore that and allow the defendant to use that money or take that money out of our possession, then our obligation under the statute would be to pay twice, to pay him and then to pay the creditor.
Even though you did it inadvertently?
Even though we did it inadvertently.
And now with a 10-day period, you'd have a greater risk of doing that, would you not?
Well, that's part of my concern. And you know, it's sometimes hard to predict how something that you're just seeing on paper in a bill is going to work in the real world. But the people that deal with this, the administration of these garnishments, are telling us that they've got lots of concerns about the potential for doing exactly that kind of thing in this 10-day period.
Chairman of the Council.
Currently, you receive writs of garnishment from the court, is that correct?
Yes.
And under this bill, you would also be receiving writs of garnishment from individual attorneys?
Yes, that's correct.
Thus, the court would not have a chance to review the process. Does that make you feel uneasy, too?
Not particularly. I guess the reason for that is that, as a practical matter, the writs are now issued by the clerk. I mean, you're not dealing with someone in robes who's sitting behind a bench making a studied review and examination of a writ of garnishment when it's issued. The process has become very mechanical. And I think that there's a lot of good in this concept of allowing attorneys to issue garnishments, provided that the appropriate controls are included. And I think the bill as it stands now contains those controls. So I'm not uncomfortable with that basic concept.
Thank you. Further questions for Mr. Sherman? Okay, Brad?
There are a couple of things we did. Mr. Sherman was discussing when we came in earlier, and most of the other concepts that he has been that he started out talking about were in fact are concepts that are technical and deal with the kind of information provided on the forms and things that we don't have any large problem with. In terms of the 10-day hold, let me explain to you some of our thinking on that when the bill was originally drafted. 10-day hold provision is a provision that's in current law, and it's put in basically in order to give the debtor a chance to file a claim of exemption during some period when the money hasn't yet gone to the creditor, and because sometimes it's difficult to get money back from a creditor. So this 10-day hold period was created in existing law to give them that sort of window of opportunity to file. Now, when we were drafting this bill, the 10-day hold period was seen as a protection for debtors. And one of the things that we were really trying to do in this bill was to change the procedures without really changing the protections. We're really trying to make the procedure work better for everybody without stinging anybody. And we've continued to work with people, and that's why I was talking to Mr. Sherman downstairs, as best we can to maintain that. So we didn't eliminate the 10-day hold period, but we had to look for someplace else to put it because the court basically has given up the fees. So the state is not getting any compensation for holding this money. There are new provisions that are added that provide for, even after the 10-day hold period, when no claim of exemption comes in and notice comes out or goes out to the other parties, that the creditor is required to send the money back into the court. So there's that added protection, but we still wanted to maintain that window. It was thought at that period, when we were drafting the bill, basically that the banks would be a logical place to have it. They have the money anyway. They're used to handling money. They would get basically the use of the money for 10 more days, and most banks charge a fee anyway for when your account is garnished. So it seemed like the logical place believe it at the time. Protect the debtor, because the debtor, the 10-day hold period was there. They wouldn't have to pay an additional fee to the court, make costs less expensive, and seem to work. And so we haven't really found anybody else other than the banks who wanted to eliminate that, and that may be a bone of contention between Mr. Sherman and myself. I'd also like to mention briefly the amendments that you've got before you that we propose. They're not something that Mr. Sherman and I went through them briefly, and they are in large part a response to the concerns of the bank about business days. We talked to most people who we had been dealing with on the bill. Under current law, anything under 7 days in legal process is deemed to be a business day anyway. And for the few instances relating to garnishees where 10 days was made 10 business days, most people said that's reasonable, especially when you're dealing with institutions. It may not be something that legal aid agreed to, but we had difficulty working with legal aid anyway. Although most of the provisions in the amendments are things that we have done to expressly address concerns that legal aid raised, I want to make it clear that they didn't agree to these amendments because they told us that they would continue to object to the bill unless this provision about allowing somebody to make a profit off of suing or guaranteed return on suing somebody for an abuse of garnishment, whatever that was, and we had difficulty finding out from them exactly what they considered to be an abuse of garnishment, something that bothered us as much as it bothered the people we talked to. But most of the rest of the amendments deal with their concerns. We have added provisions, even though they didn't agree with them. We've added provisions that provide for one place for the garnishee to file. We agreed to assume the responsibility of sending out the notice to the garnishee and the creditor to make it easier on the debtor. It increases our costs, but we felt the trade-off was not a bad trade-off. We also put in provisions that provided for the court to initiate contempt on its own motion when the money wasn't returned to the court. Again, I want to stress that this is a provision that is not an existing law. An existing law, but under this bill, in existing law, there is no requirement for the creditor to return money to the court pending a claim of exemption. The debtor has to go out and try and get it whatever way they can after the claim of exemption is determined, but we added that. And if they don't return it, we put in penalties, including contempt of court initiated on the court's own motion. We also put in provisions that provided, basically, that the clerk of court, that it was grounds for refusal to issue a clerk-issued writ if the clerk of court found that the underlying judgment wasn't there or that there was no action to base it on. Additional protections. In each instance, we tried to respond to legitimate concerns by working out with all of the parties that we can something that doesn't vary too far from what current law is, that provides a little bit for everybody, that makes the process simpler, less expensive, and more efficient, and with more protections for the debtor. We're trying to save money not only for us, but for the rest of the parties involved in garnishment, and we're trying to head off the problem that's coming in garnishment. I don't know whether my boss, Bill Linden, mentioned this earlier, but in our checks of courts, we found that a number of courts have had 20% to 30% increases of garnishment requests within the last year. And the one court has had in Lane County has had over a 70% increase for garnishment. This leads to horror stories in certain counties about taking 5 weeks for somebody to get a writ of garnishment issued through the court. We project that this is going to increase, it's going to be an increasing problem. We tried to come up with a way to deal with this problem now so that it doesn't spread statewide, to head it off so that 2 or 3 years from now you're not hearing there's a problem with garnishment, why didn't you solve it, We want it to not be a problem in 2 or 3 years. And if something isn't done now, it will be. The 5 weeks will get longer. Garnishments will move down further on the list of court clerks' priorities because they'll be taking care of other things because of other increased filings. We think it's an important bill. We think, by and large, it solves the problems. We've talked to everybody we can to get the concepts, but still, we've tried to narrow it to clarifying the law, making it an easier process, and not varying substantially from what, as a practical matter, happens under existing law. If there are any questions, I'm able to answer them.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Swank at this time? Mr. Sherman, did you want to make any comments, additional comments at this time?
Let me just clarify one thing. Brad said, and correctly, that the 10-day hold is part of the existing law. I want it to be clearly understood that what I'm saying is that's true, but the question is who holds? The existing law has the bank turn over the money within 5 days of the receipt of the garnishment. And if you'd like to see that, that's on page 27, bracketed language, beginning at line 35 of the annual.